Good evening and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. I am Yada. We've got Kirk and Larry here. I think also James. How are you guys?
Great.
Good.
Good.
Great week.
Well, man. Good. I want to thank you, Larry. You were extremely patient as it relates to the call we got into Shattering Myths from Nick. I knew that Nick had in all likelihood written some things that would have invoked criticism. Told Scott that I'm certain he had that and having read it. I said I don't need to see it. I know that he did.
He actually said he was better than Dode, and thus he should be getting the sacrifices, which, by the way, doesn't just make him better than Dode. It makes him better than Yahusha. And after having had that explained, he got sideways with five people within 10 minutes.
I've heard that would have occurred. But the reason I didn't want to go down that path, even though I knew that was the case, is that he's still a guy that has come a long way.
His primary method was himself, and I've got a screenshot. I just want to read to you guys because I was very patient. I just want to put this out. This is what he said. He immediately ran to the rabbinic group that adheres to kosher eating laws, and they began the same attacks as they always do.
Right.
And here's what he said. This is after telling us he was better than Dode. And guess what symbolism he wanted to use. He didn't want to go get frankincense and myrrh and light these plants on fire. He wanted to go get a dandelion and pour olive oil and light it in the air because his sacrifice. Boy, what a sacrifice. You know, I mean, hell, if Yahweh had known about you, Nick, he wouldn't have sent Yahusha. You know what I'm saying here. And here's what he said. I'm the guy that, and I'm not going to make fun of his language. I'm just going to read what he wrote. You know, his English is better than my Russian. I'll say that. I am the guy that able to make your girlfriend laugh at you at the bar. If you look at me crooked, I'm the guy with an even tone of my voice can make a complete fool of you. Then he said, he went into the Shattering Myths show, someplace where he could do Shattering Myths. After I showed her to count to five, I advised to check to see if her IQ just rose up. This was at the place for Shattering Myth comments. I am quite blown away by a guy who went in and said, I'm better than Dode, put himself on the same level as Noah. And by the way, Dean and also a member of ours, Jake, said, let's call a barbecue today, pal.
Yeah.
You know, why don't you have a barbecue,
All that aside. That's, in the...
Hard to put aside. He's not a friend of mine.
That's why I said I appreciate your patience with it. Because on the Shattering Myth show, it's important that I handle things differently than you would handle them in on your side. It's necessary to do so, and I appreciate you giving me the room.
Sure.
But you are also my friend and brother, and so I was depending on you. Being the guy that I know to allow me the leeway to deal with him kindly, knowing that in fact that he had said things that were irritating,
outrageous.
And I was not going to deal with the things that he had said that were outrageous. I was simply going to use everything he said to appeal to a larger audience in the sense of what did he say that has merit? What can we say about his position that would help people understand the truth rather than being isolating? And I felt that it would work better in the show, and I appreciate you giving me the latitude to do so.
And I'm not going to say anything more about the guy, but can I read a passage out of Yashayah for you here?
Sure.
Please. It says, what is it to me, the many sacrifices of yours, says Yahweh, I, this is Yahweh speaking, first person, have completely satisfied and literally fulfilled the uplifting offerings of lambs.
Yeah.
Now, until we understand this is a free gift,
and that's where I spent all of my time with him. I said, you know, all of the instructions on the sacrifices, let's go through why Noah had the clean animals and the unclean animals, why Noah was instructed regarding an altar, what the purpose of that was, is not only to feed he and his family, but also to be symbolic of the basis of the covenant, which is of Yahweh, making this sacrifice on our behalf. And so he instructed the Israelites to do these things so that it would be a word picture, a visual representation that they could live every year that would help them understand what God himself would do and now has done. And so everything we do in this regard, its merit now is strictly our recognition that Yahweh has done these things, to meet with him and answer the invitation for these celebrations at the time that he has done them, and to
for the purposes of understanding.
Correct.
For the purposes of understanding.
That's what I shared with him, and I knew you would not disagree with any of that. I just decided that...
I shared that with him, too. So did five other people.
Right. And that there... Now, I will also say, and I don't think you have any problem with this either, Larry, but, you know, challenge me if you do, that I don't have a problem with somebody saying that, you know, I want to actually follow many of the instructions to as great a degree as I can, recognizing that all I'm doing here is symbolically demonstrating to my family and to my children, maybe even to myself, the basis of what Yahweh has done for us. Like, for example, at Tabernacles, at Sukkah, one of my best friends, he and his family all go into one of the rooms, a utility room in the house, and they pitch tents. Now, I don't pitch a tent during Sukkah, but I think what they do is charming. I think it has merit for their family. They look forward to doing it together. They're not doing it to be saved. They're not doing it because they're to obey. They're doing it because by enacting the symbolism, the whole family celebrates what God has conveyed.
And I would agree with you, and I have no problem with that. I'm just trying to picture how somebody's better than Dode because of their personal behavior. And that's what he's into, personal behavior.
Well, I would tell you
that. Somebody does that. They
can I challenge that perspective?
Line.
Just give me a challenge.
Sure.
I'm a rascal. I've got lots of issues. Dode was a rascal on steroids. Well, my personal behavior is something that I would never ask anybody to emulate, and I'm certainly not proud of, and I'm glad that God is unaware of. My personal behavior is probably better than Doug's. I'd go so far as to say my personal behavior, you know, I don't have a harem. I have never tried to get somebody killed so I could take their wife. You know, there's a lot of things. I've never been a outright traitor. There's a lot of things that Doe did that are far worse than anything I've ever done. Now, that said, that isn't what matters with Doe. That's only there so that you know that being good is essentially irrelevant.
Right, which is exactly what
the concept has it completely wrong. Being good is irrelevant. What Doe has over me in spades, and I think, now I'm going to brag here a little bit. I think that in terms of being right, understanding who Yahweh is and what he's offering, and being able to understand it and convey it, you know, I think I'm one in a million in that. I think I'm, you know, I'm not going to have the best, but I'm up there, you know. And, you know, I don't even think that I'm in the same hemisphere in that regard as Dode. Where it really matters, which is understanding Yahweh, and being able to convey that in a way that is helpful to people, I'm 1 billionth of Dode. So where it matters, I'm inferior to him. Where it doesn't matter, I think we're probably all better.
You have to understand, though, that that's true, and I'm agreeing with everything you say, except you're better than one in a million on that, by the way. But when somebody says, and they openly go into other rooms and say, these people are using yada yada over a Bible, please let me finish.
Okay. Yeah.
You're goddamn right I am. Now, wait a minute. You're goddamn right I am. Because I would rather look at honest translations and see the shades and the meanings of words and how deep they go than something that was intentionally poisoned.
Yes,
I put yada yada above a holy Bible. I put ITG above a holy Bible. One's honest and the other isn't.
That's true. I've got no problem with that. I don't like the term Bible because it means with Baal, in Baal, and with confusion. And so when somebody says they're comparing my translations and commentary to with Baal, in Baal, and by way of confusion, I'm really irritated. And so it is difficult for me to pause long enough to say, all right, I'm going to listen to what you have to say because maybe there's something we can communicate here that has value, knowing full well that I've stated that those are fighting words for me. I don't like that. Now, I would tell you here, Larry, that there is that I think now you're being unfair to yourself.
No,
there
I don't.
Okay, let me tell you this. I'm just going to convey this, and then we're going to go to what I think is a goosebump passage. I think that there may have been a period of time, 7 or 8 years ago, where you cited yada yada and the translations in it as your response to things before you had completely incorporated that, before it became part of the fabric of your life. At this point, you understand it, know it, know how to wield Yah's testimony in such a way that, in my view, you own it as much as I own it. They're as much my translations as they are your translations. You have come to embody Yahweh's message. You understand who Yahweh is and what he's saying, and because you've transitioned from knowing to understanding, when you're citing those translations, you are communicating the testimony of the God that you've come to know. They're yours.
Right, and it was through the building of hundreds of notes, by the way. That's
right,
all
of course.
That's what it
and
was.
Lots of thought and lots of connections and lots of engagements.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I would dare say this, and I think you would have to agree with me, Kirk. You chime in. JB, please chime in. Yada yada. And the path of the Moed Mikra and the explanations, Yahweh's words with every possible meaning, and also the commentary, would lead a person to Yahweh about a million times quicker than a Bible would. Do you agree with that?
I don't think you can get there with a Bible anymore.
I don't either. It's impossible.
Yeah. And I think that the guys that even back in the day when my translations were really crude, and I'm not going to claim they're great now, but they are 1,000 times better than your English Bible, 100 times to somewhere between 100 and 1,000 times better than the English Bible. But
they're infinitely better.
By my first pass, I would say that the translations now are 10 times better than they originally were, maybe 100 times better than they originally were.
Okay.
That the original translations, as crude as they were, without understanding the stems, the conjugations, or the moods, and having a simplistic, superficial view of the words themselves. I know for certain that anybody who read those initial translations 15 years ago with an open mind came to know Yahweh. They were sufficient. My flawed and imperfect tool of translating his testimony and then in encouraging people to think about it with all of its errors and flaws that had to be corrected 7 times in edits. That was sufficient to lead an open-minded. You guys are all examples. You didn't read the current version. You read the original versions.
Mm-hmm.
And I've made, 10,000 corrections. So it was sufficient. Now, I think what we have now is even more thoughtful, thought-provoking.
No, it's undoubtedly. better.
Sure. This is from Proverbs 6, and Proverbs 6 came to us by way of William.
Mm-hmm.
William said, you know, I want to understand this, and Larry, you then chimed in, and the two of you sent it to me, and I said, you know, I'm gonna take the time to translate. So I've used every free moment I've had in the last 4 or 5 days to translate it, and I'm just blown away. I mean, I really, really love this passage, because this passage affirms probably the most criticized stand that we have taken, which is you can't be religious. You can't be political. You can't be pro-military. You can't be patriotic and expect to form a relationship with God. And that God expressly despises these things, and he wants you to walk away from them. And he thinks that the best relationship between he and humankind is when it's one-on-one and there's no intermediary. And he expects us to stop being apathetic. He wants us to engage. He wants us to study. He wants us to be active in our observations so that we come to understand, and we'll become to understand. He wants us to confront those who are in adversarial positions, whether they be religious or political. And come to find out, Proverbs 6 says all of that directly. It's really good stuff. So why don't we start? It begins. My son, my child. God is speaking as dad. My son, my child. If you have given a pledge and have joined in to be accepted with regard to your country, if you have bound yourself to it, having shaken hands with that which is illegitimate and unauthorized, then you've shaken hands with that which is foreign and exchanged, estranged from the palm of my hand.
That's pretty
powerful for all of us.
Yeah.
You know, Larry, you were in the military.
Yes.
Kirk, your dad took you out of the country so you wouldn't have to endure the military, but you know, you were in a country where it was God save the Queen, and you were here long enough to do the Pledge of Allegiance. I was very religious, very patriotic. I did all this stuff. I gave the pledge. I joined in to be accepted. And that's the whole nature of religion. You join in to be accepted, and all of these things have a pledge. The military has a pledge. Schools have pledges. Fraternities have pledges. And they all have pledges. My son, if you have given a pledge, the Romans required a pledge, an oath of allegiance to them, of every citizen. If you joined in to be accepted with regard to your country, with your countrymen, your social, geopolitical, racial, or religious group, even your neighbors and fellow citizens, then you have bound yourself, having shaken hands with that which is illegitimate and unauthorized, foreign and estranged from my hand. Kirk, I know you've looked at this both in commentaries and in other translations. That's not what they say, is it?
No. They missed the mark completely.
But that's what the words say.
Yeah.
Yeah, the hardest thing here is my hand at the end of it. God speaking in first person. My hand, and which requires you to convey the full concept of Hazar, which is illegitimate and unauthorized, foreign and estranged from. And so it's the estranged from his hand. And it's estranged from his hand because it is illegitimate and unauthorized. That's what the concept is all about. So, you know, you bound yourself having shaken hands with that which is estranged from God. And when you look at the Garden of Eden, which is representative of heaven, you don't find anything in the Garden of Eden that's estranged from God. In fact, the moment HaSatan, who is estranged from God, walks into the Garden of Eden and misquotes Yahweh, and Adam and Hawa become estranged from God, they're immediately booted out of the garden, aren't they? All of them.
Yes.
you can't be in God's home in association with something that is unauthorized and is strange for him.
He is completely consistent.
See, he is completely consistent, but here he is being blunt. Now, what's really interesting here is I don't think I have come across a stem that was more revealing than the Niffl stem in this context and in the context which follows. You lure others into relinquishing their freedom, and you yourself are ensnared and controlled. Now, the reason you have to present this both ways, as the perpetrator and as the victim of your cause, being entrapped, being constrained, being governed, being baited, being enticed, and enticing, baiting, governing, and constraining, is that the Niffl stem, I'm not making this up, this is just what you look at any sophisticated lexicon of Hebrew where they provide access to the stems, they will say the following. The Niffl stem is the reflective variation of the call. So the call is the principal stem of relationships whereby the relationship being to the action, being described, needs to be interpreted literally and actually and genuinely. No, this is not a hypothetical, this is for real. So the Niffl stem should be interpreted literally and actually, but it's reflexive. And so what they will all tell you is that with the Niffl stem, that the action of the verb as it relates to the subject of the verb, that the subject of the verb is both the actor, the perpetrator of the action, and the recipient of the action. Now, we don't have any concept in English like that, where the subject is both the perpetrator of the action and the recipient of the action. So the only way you can convey that in English, when the action is to entice, to entrap, to constrain others, to rob someone of their freedom, or to be robbed of your freedom, is you have to say it both ways. You lure others, you entice them to relinquish their freedom. But in so doing, you yourself are ensnared and controlled. So this is the concept that Yahweh wants you to understand of why you ought not acquiesce to a government, why you ought not join the military, why you ought not make a pledge to a religious order. Because you'll think you're making that pledge to join in and to be part of, and to but when you make that pledge, that oath, you are not only limiting your freedom, but by going along with the group, you're having the freedom of others constrained. If Americans didn't support their military would not be able to constrain their freedom. If fewer Americans voted, American officials would not be able to constrain the freedom of Americans. So by our making this pledge, we not only create the scenario that reduces our freedom, but we also, by collectively working together, reduce the freedoms of others. So it is a powerful and a very insightful way to look at why God doesn't want us aligning ourselves with political and religious systems. So if you lure others into relinquishing their freedom, then you yourself are ensnared and controlled. By the words of your mouth, you are caught by way of your statements. So God's saying right here, you do not have an excuse. I'm telling you that you need to be very careful of what you say. As Glenn called in the Shattering Myths program today, he said, Yosha said it very simply. Don't give an oath. Let your yes be a yes, let your no be a no. Don't provide an oath. That's what Yahweh was saying. I don't even think Yahweh wants us to provide an oath to him. I just think, let your yes be yes and your no be no. You know, it comes to the conditions of the covenant, the invitation to meet with him. It's a yes from all of us. Let your yes be a yes. Yeah. So he's saying that these oaths that we make, these pledges that we make, these enticements that we make, it's a double-edged sword. Yeah, we may think that by being integrated into the group that we gain more access to the things that we want, that we're included and receive the benefits. But in fact, what we're doing is constraining all of us, including ourselves.
Can I, in a very powerful way,
to look at this.
Can I throw something in here that, really is right there? It's got a lot to do with it. You know, there are a group of people that understand Yahweh has a name and Lord ain't it.
Right.
And yet they want to hang on to Apollos, who has misled billions. And they, of course, say, well, he's misunderstood and this and that and the other thing. I know he isn't. But yet there in Shabbat, what does it say about the people who can't let go of Paul?
That they will find their own.
And they're also taken away as booty, aren't they? That's what it says.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're essentially his prey.
So these are people, even though they understand this, they probably don't understand. They know about the seven Moed Mikra, with a lack of understanding, of course. But they know about it, and they use Yahweh's name, and they know about the seventh day and all this. But they have to adhere to that piece of poison, don't they?
Yeah.
And if Yahweh's words are
true, my view is that if you want to hold on to that piece of poison, well, I will have some empathy for you in the sense of I was once there.
Mm-hmm.
So long as you hold on to that piece of poison and you're not willing to let go, I'm going to distance myself from you. I have nothing to do with
right. That's right.
I'm going to provide an absolute, irrefutable 1,200 pages of evidence that could have been 10 times that long that proves that that's a poor choice on your behalf. But my job is to simply tell you the truth, point you in the right direction, and if you don't want to go there, I'm going to disassociate from you.
And
if somebody wants to advance Pauline doctrine or speak of Paul as if he were inspired, I'm repulsed. For me, it's disgusting.
Well, what it looks like after you throw all the information out to them is it looks like they just, for the life of them, for their own very life, it's they can't let go of religious material. They can't walk out of Babylon.
Right.
And what I would say, once we've shared words with somebody, it's particularly four, five, six different people, and they don't want to understand and they don't want to walk out of Babylon, I'm under no obligation to throw chains on them and drag them out of Babylon, kicking and screaming on a wild horse.
But if you don't want it.
I mean, and if they want to die, they care that little about their life and they prefer their oath to the military or their oath to Paul. That's what it really is.
Paul demanded their own life.
Paul demanded
an oath. Yahweh doesn't. None of the prophets do. Doe didn't. They didn't demand an oath of allegiance. King Saul did. Paul did. So Yahweh has a plan here. Larry, you're going to like this plan. I like this plan. Kirk, I know you like this plan.
I like the plan.
So then, engage thusly, my son, and choose to escape, defending yourself. This is a really interesting word, this walk, not Saul. Of your own free will, because it was written in the imperative, and the imperative is second person volition. He's speaking to his son, therefore us, and therefore in this sentence, we are second person. So of your own free will, my child, elect to tear yourself away, delivering yourself from harm, thereby saving yourself from unfavorable circumstances. Also written in the Nephilim. This idea of escaping and defending oneself, we are both the perpetrator and the recipient of the action. We escape, and by fleeing, we are defended. By delivering ourselves from harm, we are saved. God wants us to do something here. He is not going to save you while you're being religious, is what he's saying. If you're being religious, I'm not going to save you. I can't save you while you're being religious. If you want to be saved, exactly religion.
You have to act first.
You have to act first. That is exactly right. If don't, you know, excuse me, with Abraham. Yahweh gave Abraham an invitation. But if Abraham didn't engage and walk away from Babylon at that moment, then he would never have formed a relationship with Yahweh, would never have heard of him. Before Yahweh could offer him anything, Dod first had to be willing to walk away from Babylon. And that's what this says. So, then, engage thusly. So then act upon this. Doing this now, as a logical, thoughtful, and sequential response, the first thing you need to do is walk away. The best defense is separating yourself from these things. You know, and I'm going to tell you that until you are willing to walk away from religion, you've got no chance of understanding who Yahweh is or what he's offering. None. You're going to fight everything. Every bit of what God says is going to be rejected by you. So his advice is, so then engage thusly, my child, and choose to escape defending yourself. Now, this is powerful, and I'm so glad that it's written this way because it is helpful, particularly for those like me who were once religious, once political. For if, even temporarily, you have actually come to bowing down before the hand, the influence or control of your country, in a unpretentious way, go then, he says, in an unpretentious way, and press one's bonus attention with the adversarial individual or institution, boldly astonishing and overwhelming them, showing great courage against your fellow countrymen, your social, geopolitical, racial, and or religious group. Well, there's enough we could spend an hour just on this sentence, but it actually even gets better from this point. So
I have no problem with this. Matter of fact, I love doing this. I have done it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you and me.
I love doing it. You know, it's a beautiful thing. And you should see
a beautiful thing.
They're angry. They're angry.
Now, you think that the word, the verb here is bow. First, the conditional statement is key. If. Yeah, for if. That's a conditional statement. Key. But then the verb is bow. Bow just means come. That's all bow means, come. So, this, even temporarily, the reason that I wrote even temporarily as it relates to modifying come is that come here was written in the perfect conjugation. The perfect conjugation says that if at one time or at a period of time which is now over, or at some time in the future, but for a very finite period of time, you did this, but you have either stopped doing it or are about to stop doing it, then it's written in the, that's what the perfect conveys. So you have to say, for if even temporarily, for if at some time in the past, if once but not again, or twice but not a third time, you have actually come to doing this. So the perfect, you know, I don't think that God is sloppy. The God I know isn't sloppy. The God I know doesn't use the uniqueness of Hebrew stems and conjugations and moods recklessly, thoughtlessly. Each one is chosen to convey an extraordinarily important aspect of that action. And in the case of for if you have come, to write it as if it were something that was habitual, that was ongoing, he would have chosen the imperfect. But he didn't. This is a behavior that has to stop. And so God is saying, now, if you've done this, but you're not currently doing it, if you've done this, but you've stopped doing it, then
you're okay. Yeah.
Right. But you need to stop. Before you do anything else, I don't want you as part of the military to go criticize the officer in the military. I don't want you as the ordained ruling elder in the church to go criticize the pastor. Leave it first. Once you've left it, then do it. Leave it first. You know, I've had so many people write me and they say, you know, I'm in this church and I want to take what you've said and confront the pastor with it. And I said, don't do that. Don't do that. What I want you to do is two things. One is I want you to spend a year where you take an hour or two every night for a year and you study Yahweh's testimony. You can either translate it on your own or use the translation that I provided for you. But you come to know this material because you are not prepared to deal with objections and questions on your own. And until you are, you ought not confront them because you can't overwhelm them. You can't astonish them. You need to first prepare. And the second thing is you need to leave the church. Leave the church, get your act right with God, and then go and do it. I'm not saying you shouldn't do it, but I'm saying there's two prerequisites. Come to know the truth by investing your time. Get off your duff. It's not going to come easy. And boy, does God ever say that. He is all over the apathetic individual that wants to be fed. You know, give me the short answer. You know, can you summarize what this is? Can you write me a personal response to this question? I don't want to have to read the whole book. God's view of those people is very negative. And so this is get your act together, learn the truth, come to understand the truth, separate yourself from that organization, and then, and only then, should you confront them. But then you ought to confront them. So the next part of it is if you have bowed down before the hand, influence, or control. And now, if you just read cough, Kirk, if you just go to your lexicon on cough, which is the first thing you see?
Hand.
Yeah. But the verbal root of cough is also, K-A-P-H is also the verbal root of the word, isn't it? And most of the lexicons will tell you that cough is the verbal root. Did you check to see what the verbal root, the actionable definition of the open palm is?
I think I did, but go ahead.
I'll save you some time because I did it. Yeah. Because I was really, really surprised. But it immediately came to me. It makes perfect sense. It means to bend down or bow down.
Oh, you okay, know, I do have that in my notes, yeah.
So I don't have a problem with the verbal root of cough immediately in this context being if you've bowed down before the hand or authority, bowing down before a pope, you know, but bowing down before the hand or authority, submitting, if you will, to the authority. And immediately, you know, well, the verbal root is defining this action here, and you need the verbal root to understand what God is saying. If you've bow down to submit yourself to human authority, then you need to stop, flee it, and then address those that you've conveyed this to, because you having acquiesced to them makes their situation worse. You need to reverse it, and you need to make a wrong thing right. But the problem I had is that cough was used in the first person, my cough, my open hand, in the opening statement here. And so we're just a couple of statements from that, and now the hand is the authority of religious and political institutions.
So
I'm saying, okay, well, God doesn't want you bowing down, but what's the primary meaning of cough is to bend down. And so you think of, whoa, Yahweh, first thing he says to Adam after creating him, I knelt down. I diminished myself in love to lift him up. And so when you're talking about the open hand of Yahweh, he is bending over, diminishing himself to lift us up. So it's either bowing or bending, depending on whose hand we're talking about. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it gives you a lot of insight, but you've got to take the time to look at the verbal root and then consider the context. Whose hand are we talking about? Okay, so for if, even temporarily, you have actually come to bowing down before the hand, influence, or control of your country, then go, walk, move in an unpretentious way. devoid of arrogance, so much so that you're willing to get a bit dirty. That you're willing even to, in fact, that primary definition, you're willing to tread in the mud. And then press one's bone of contention with the adversarial individual or institution, boldly astonishing and overwhelming them, showing great courage in the process against your fellow countrymen, your geopolitical, racial, and or religious group. This is the part that we, I think, as a group, love. And I don't know if you love it too much, but I love it.
I can promise you over in UT, we put up with zero of the religious, the militaristic, the governmental BS.
Right.
All of us
will
bounce a person there in a second for nonsense because we don't need it there.
Right. Now, I will tell you the first part of this resonates with me because I spent, 7-8 years of my life wallowing in the mud of Muhammad's drivel to expose and condemn Islam. I devoted 2 years of my life to wallowing in the muck of Paul. And you've got to, in a way, humble yourself to be willing to do that. You know, here we are, sons and daughters of the Almighty. We've got it made. And yet, there comes a time, particularly if you have been religious in your past, particularly if you've been political in your past, there comes a time where you got to get back down there in the dirt and walk to and come to expose and condemn face-to-face the most vile institutions on the planet. And you get dirty in the process, and you get muddy in the process. And it takes a bit of humility, but it's not humility in the sense of woe is me. It's you've got to be willing to do the dirty work. And God says do it in great courage, but you've got to be willing to do the dirty work. And he says do it bluntly, do it boldly, do it in such a way that you just absolutely astonish them. Give them, you know, my thing that I've always been accused of is the fire hose. I give people more information faster than they can process it. That's good. Give them the fire hose.
Oh, good.
I say drown them in it. That's what
you
I say.
Drown them in it. Overwhelm them.
In it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just overwhelm them. Astonish them. Be bold.
You do that and you may possibly get someone questioning.
Yeah.
Well, that's what happens. With what I do and with what Craig's doing, I mean, obviously, people read it.
Well, we all do.
You know, the people who want to know, read it. If, you know, and it's particularly in a debate when they only have 8 or 10 passages to read. They don't have to read all of yada yada there. And I buried them 5 different ways, I promise you, with those passages. In a debate.
Well, in a way, it serves to weed out those who aren't willing to put forth the time and the effort.
Yes, typically the person who's
not willing to read that, they don't want to know God.
Right. Typically, the person you're debating does not want to know, but in an open forum like I am, that's how almost everybody got there. They either listened to Shattering Myths or they came through Bless Yahweh, or they came through the notes, one way or another. But these are all debate forums in a way, and people have to read them and question. I mean, they have to.
What I think you're doing here is the person that doesn't walk away from religion first, that isn't willing to let go of the religion. If you don't do that first, that's why God says you have to do this in sequitur. The first thing is you need to distance yourself from religion. If you don't do that first, nothing matters. But if you've done that and you're open, then what he says is going to resonate with a very significant percentage of the audience.
Yeah.
And, you know, you might blow them away. It may be way too much information for them to process. But, you know, it's one of those things where, okay, we've just presented here a lifetime's worth of knowledge into the uniqueness of Yahweh, and we're going to get much deeper. And there may be some who are listening and say, you know, that, boy, I'm trying to incorporate all this, process it, understand it, accept it. And there's others that have already spent a decade processing, learning, understanding. And all this is doing is reinforcing that which they've already come to know. And so the more time that we are invested in this material, the more of it we absorb, the more of it we come to own, the more of it becomes the fabric of our lives. So there's no problem in giving people more than they can process, because some can process it because they are prepared to process it. Others will take a nugget of it and then from there chew on that, like cud, and digest it a little bit and then take another bite.
Can I just say a quick sure. thing? Is I've been probably fire hosing people because I get real excited about it, and I'll tell them
yeah, to
lead to that, and that'll lead to that, and then if they ask me, we'll keep on and keep on. And I can sit there sometimes with a. It happened a lot with some students sometimes for 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah.
And they would go home, and I would be exhausted. They were exhausted. It was, but I was exhilarated, and they seemed to be. And it might go on for a day or two. It may end there. But I have found, and the disappointing part was, something will happen, and they will either pick up the books and start reading, or they will just walk away, and 99% will just walk away.
Yeah, I don't think of those that I don't think it's quite 99%. I think it's a higher percentage of those who are open and willing to invest the time to listen. But you know, we're in a really tough time. You know, we have people who have been indoctrinated in political correctness where they've lost the concept of good judgment. They don't understand how you process information in a discriminating way to form a conclusion. They don't know how you make connections between things to go from knowledge to understanding. The whole process of thinking is so foreign to them that you almost have to start at the beginning and say, first let me teach you how to think. Then let me teach you what you can and cannot rely upon and how you can determine whether or not something is reliable. And then let me prove to you that religion is wrong so that you pull that away from your eyes so that you at least have a clear perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And now that you know these things, let's then consider who God is apart from any preconceived notions. And it's so much work to get there with today's audience because we have been so dumbed down.
Well, an awful lot of people just won't do the self-study. You can't convince me you can get here if you don't crack some books yourself.
Well, wait till you hear what Yara has to say about that.
Okay.
He's going to talk about that here in a few more statements. All right, so let's move on. Do not give yourself over to slumber, to being unaware, to being comatose, to being apathetic, to being inactive, where you're not fully awake and alert, and by implication, tending to die, leading to death, to no longer being alive. So what is Yahweh's view of the position of apathy, of, you know, I'm not fully alert. I'm not fully engaged.
I'm not aware. My eyes
I'm not
are
aware.
Lazy. Yeah,
right. Do not give yourself over to apathy, to being comatose, to any altered state of awareness. I will tell you that political correctness is primarily conceived by academia to change people's awareness, to alter their sense of awareness so that they're no longer aware of right and wrong, good and bad, truth and lies. And I would also say that we live in a society where entertainment is specifically designed to create an altered state, where you're brought into the theme of a movie and the life of somebody in a movie, where the movie stars, you know, take you into a false world. The video games, a false sense of reality. Our politicians thrive on the perceptions become the new reality. We are a drug society. with all sorts of mind-numbing, mind-altering drugs, and drugs that, like even alcohol, that change your sense of awareness. And so, between our educational institutions and our politicians promoting political correctness, which creates an altered state of awareness, and the drugs and our entertainment and our video games collectively, this is the single biggest problem with humankind.
You know, along those lines, along those lines, you can actually almost tell what the elite who want to keep everybody under this spell and this propaganda, using these propaganda techniques, are up to, because you will see, you know, for 3 years they'll push environmentalism and global warming. And then the next thing you see, your top 100 movies are all military action, and so are your video games.
Right.
And so all they're really doing is getting people to a place where this
American
is the
sniper. Yes.
This is what they should be
30.
Doing.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, well, they came out with 50 of them now. They've actually got a channel called American Hero Channel.
Right.
You
know, they're hawking on shattering myths. The military Bible stick. Of the, you know, it's a provocative New Testament that you're supposed to spend $25 to give to your hero so that he has God's peace on the battlefield.
Yep. You were talking about that. That's so
pathetic. Just
want to
puke. So God says here that do not give yourself over to inactivity, to being apathetic, to being inactive, where you're not fully aware. Concerning especially your eyes, your perspective, your understanding, your sight, your ability to be observant, and the activity by way of an altered state of awareness of your eyelids. And the reason he's repeating this and associating the inactivity of our eyes is that there really is one way to become observant and knowing, and that is you've got to read. You just got to read. I mean, I spend the first hour of that Shattering the Show exposing and condemning politics and religion based upon what I read. And I read 10 to 15 different newspapers, and I read 10 or more headline stories from 10 to 15 newspapers every morning.
Yeah, but you're a Renaissance man. The rest of us can't keep up with you.
He's a speed reader.
No, I'm not special. You've got to, if you want to know, you've got to read.
You got to know.
Did you spend some time with Evelyn Wood?
No.
Okay, I was just wondering. I want to ask.
But you've got to read if you want to know. Well, for example, when I went about exposing Seventh-day Adventists. Now, Ben Carson is a minister in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. I had to read everything that they believe in. I mean, I did 10, 15 shows. Because
weren't they wrong at 25 points?
Yeah, 24 out of 25 they were wrong. Yeah.
That was so pathetic.
And the founder,
and if you really thought it out, it really, you were
founder
right
was
about
an absolute scumbag. And she was demon-possessed.
She would.
A woman who was hallucinating based upon satanic prophecies. It's a really scary religion. But you got to read. You know, and then on the other side, Yahweh is going to tell you the antidote for all that ails us is his Torah. And there is no way to know the Torah apart from reading it. So it's your eyes that have to be exercised. If you don't exercise your eyes, there is no hope for you. So when Yahweh is talking about here, these are the things you've got to do. You can't have a sense of apathy. You've got to have a hunger and a thirst to know, and the way that you come to know is from your eyes. Got to use your eyes. We were given eyes for a reason. Now, he says, choose to escape, defending yourself like a gazelle from the hand of power, and similar to a chirping bird from the fowler. Now, as I read this, I said, all right, this is not my favorite stuff. I'm not great. When God gets into word pictures, I said, okay. I'm not in Doe's class. I understand that. But, you know, I'm not in the class of the illiterate man or woman that was part of the Exodus. And so the simplistic animalistic word pictures have never tripped my trigger. And so I immediately said, okay, you know, gazelle and bird, don't, you know, guard yourself and be aware. And then I said, well, let me shed my sense of arrogance here and say, okay, why did he choose gazelle and bird, particularly this particular bird, which is a small sparrow?
I found it in a lexicon today. Absolutely matches what he
So let me tell you what I thought, and then, Kirk, you can challenge this if you found something that's different.
No, I didn't find it. It reinforced everything you said.
This is what I found. The word for gazelle happens to be very similar to the word for sadak, which means upright.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I thought about a gazelle. Does a gazelle have any teeth that could hold off a predator?
Yeah.
No.
Does the gazelle really have any defense mechanism?
No, only against another gazelle or something where they're...
Yeah, two boy gazelles can bang horns for the right to do a female gazelle, but that's it. Now,
that's
so
not it.
A gazelle...
I saw one ate a bird one day in a video. People were blown away. Ate a bird.
Now, the gazelle has a defense mechanism, and that's the reason why there are gazillions of gazelles.
They can run, hop, jump.
Is that the gazelle is always alert. If you look at a gazelle in the wild, the ears are up, the head's up, the eyes are always scanning the horizon, the neck's going side to side. If there's two or more gazelles, they're all facing different directions, they're paying attention. They're very observant.
They're even listening to the monkeys.
Yeah. So the gazelle is very observant, paying attention to the birds, because the birds might flee when there's a lion in the area or hyena, paying attention to everything, every sound, every movement, every shadow. The gazelle is paying attention. They are observant. And the gazelle doesn't screw around. When the gazelle senses that there might be danger lurking, they don't wait. They don't embrace it. They don't say, oh, when it gets here, I'll deal with it. They're gone, and they're agile, and they're quick about it. So what is Yahweh telling us about the gazelle? Be upright. Be on your feet. Be ready to go. Be paying attention. Don't hang around. The moment you recognize that there's the danger of a human institution that could somehow harm you or will harm you or your family, move. React. That's what I learned when I studied gazelle, and all of a sudden I was saying, that's pretty astute. Do you find anything different than that, Kirk?
No, he calls him a splendor and a beautiful and a glorious animal and so forth, and quick, but Sadak was the one. And what I do is I don't read your stuff until I look them up.
Yeah.
So that I don't let you influence me.
Yeah. I would influence you using the Hebrew.
I want you to help me connect the dots. I go connect the dots, and then I come back and see how close I can.
I like doing the same thing. I'll translate it, and then I'll look at what
then I'll see what
you did. And be like, okay, how did he get that different than me? Okay, I see what he did there.
I take much more liberty than I used to take in translating, because I try now to always put the root. You know, if I'm going to augment something with what's not there in the initial definition, I'll say this is from this, which means this, and I'll augment it by the root. But I'm always looking at the words that are written the same way, just pointed differently, recognizing that a word written the same way, pointed differently, is the same word in the text.
Right.
And so, and then, you know, you study Hebrew long enough, when you see a word that clearly conveys the concepts of Sadak and the definitions are similar to Sadak, and Sadak happens to be one of Yahweh's favorite words. It's one of my favorite words. It's the word that has caused me to say something that, Larry, I know resonates with you because you've mentioned it a bunch of times. It really resonates with me that my goal is not to be good. My goal is to be right. Sadak is the Hebrew word for right. Dode wasn't good. Dode was right. Being right is life and death. It's everything. it's the source to everything that is good comes from being right. And I don't care how good you are, you never get to right by being good. And so Sadak, when this had all the markings of Sadak, I just went there. Then I said, okay, what's this next word? This next word is Sipor. Well, or in Hebrew is the Hebrew word for light.
Light, yeah.
Yeah, and TS is the Hebrew word, conveys the idea of a signpost on the way. But Sipor is the Hebrew word, based on the Hebrew word, that speaks of a small chirping bird, a bird that sings. And it's a small bird, like a sparrow. And the reason that the root is chosen, it's not only because it's a singing bird, a bird that chirps, and God really likes us to chit-chat. I mean, he wants us to talk. That's what this is all about. You know, be eager to sing your song, to sing his song. But it's the sparrow, and it's defined as the sparrow which departs early, the first to leave. So if there's a problem in the area, a potential problem, first gone. Right. You know, I was the first of those that I knew that realized I needed to walk away from my religion, and then soon thereafter from my politics, and then soon thereafter from patriotism. And so, you know, I feel in a way I'm a sparrow which departed early. And I'm a sparrow that likes to sing. But what does also the sparrow have? Does the sparrow have an ability to ward off harm? If the sparrow is going to fight the cat, does it have any means to defeat the cat?
Absolutely not.
None.
I can assure you, they do not. No way.
They're up in a room, and I bet the cat wins every time.
Well, you know, I tried to save a little sparrow, and my cat ran across the room with it in his mouth, and I never saw the poor guy again.
Yeah.
That was it.
So, what Yahweh is saying with these two is, I don't want you to be armed with the hilt. I don't want you to save yourself from government and from the military and from your religion by being armed. You know, these guys that go off and kill based upon, you know, they don't like Muslims, and they go off and kill. And God didn't say, don't do it that way. I'm not telling you that I want you to do it like the bear or the lion or the tiger or the hyena or the wolf. I don't want you protecting yourself by engaging violently. No. When you got this kind of trouble, all I want you to do is walk away from it. Be observant, move quick, and flee them. Just disassociate with them. I'm not here because I want you to go to war with them. That's profound. That's what we keep on saying on this program. I must have said it between shattering this and here 1,000 times.
Mm-hmm.
Don't respond violently. God is telling you, I don't want you to respond violently. I just want you to disassociate with it. Be aware. Be quick to leave. Be the chirping bird, though. And tell everybody else why you're leaving, but leave.
It's funny, that's
you don't need, you don't need to go
blow
them. Don't get a club. You don't need to go kill them. The gun's not going to do any good. It's going to do you more harm than good. So that was pretty profound. But what I read next, oh my goodness. I mean, this was one of my favorite things that I have read in a month of Sundays. Should have probably said a month of Sabbaths.
Yes, you should.
I should have said a month of Sabbaths. See, I'm imperfect and flawed. Okay. The habitually inactive and lethargic. The lazy bones, those who are sluggish, lacking discipline, ambition, or resourcefulness, should see, observing and examining the conduct of the ant, her ways, and be wise. The ant! God's telling us we should look at the ant. And he says, particularly if you're inactive, particularly if you're someone who's apathetic, you need to look at the ant, her ways, and be wise.
They're
now, the first
constantly
thing
on
about,
the move.
He talks about her ways, and it's always her. Do you know that about 99.9% of ants are females?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that until I looked it up.
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, it's just like bees. All of them are females until they need drones.
Yeah. The only ones that fertilize the eggs are drones. they're not even really males, but they're drones. Ants are females. So he's talking about females.
We didn't
know that until just recently. But
that's cute the way they put her in there.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty cute. Beneficially, and from a relationship perspective, Azure, she has no leader. No commander or officer. No government or imposed authority. She has no work foreman. She has no public official. She doesn't even have a clerk or a scribe. Nor does she have anyone claiming to be in charge or in control, especially a lord who reigns over her. Whoa! He's telling you to look at the ant, oh, you apathetic one, and to recognize all of the industry, all of the activity of an ant, all of the work of an ant. And they've got no government. They've got no religion. They've got no king. They've got no leader of any kind. There's not even a work foreman. There's no general. There's no officer. There's no scribe. There's no judge. There's no policeman. They got none of it. And God says, if you look at them and understand them, you'll be wise. Now, I'm going to tell you, folks, when this was written 2,500 years ago, 3,000 years ago, there wasn't anybody on the planet that knew that there was no hierarchy among ants. No one knew that. We've only come to know that in the last 25 years or so. We call it a queen ant. The queen ant is a label that humans have put on it, but who knows why we even came up with that name. The queen ant has no authority. She doesn't make any rules. She doesn't govern the hive.
Yeah, she just sits there and fertilizes eggs all the time.
Yeah, she doesn't fertilize. She lays
eggs.
The drones fertilize them.
She has
a miserable existence.
Lays fertilized eggs.
She lays eggs and the drones fertilize
them. Her time.
Right.
Yeah, she's just like this glom sitting there. Right.
Oh, it's terrible. It is a miserable existence. Never gets outside. Never sees the light. Never gets to move. It is an awful, awful existence. But she's not a queen. She's an egg layer. But God is saying that we would be wise if we understood the ant. And I thought that he was going to say, because the ant is so industrious. And the immediate thing that came to mind, and I think God is conveying this to some extent, that he wants people around him who are ambitious. He wants people who are go-getters. He wants people who are workers around him. God doesn't want sluggards around him. He's saying all the time, don't be a sluggard. Don't be lazy. Over and over again. God does not like sluggards. He doesn't like those people who are inactive and lazy. What God's telling you is engage. Work. Go off and do something. Make a contribution. Be active. And then, so that's part of it. Look how, an ant can lift 15 times their body weight.
It's more than that, I believe. I think it's more like 50. But
the thing I read was 15. But that doesn't mean that there's probably some ant that can lift 50. But just think of that as a human. If you're 150 pounds, there's very few 150-pound people that could lift twice their body weight, 300 pounds. That'd probably be 1 in 1,000 that could do that. And here we're talking about 7 times that, at the very limit, the very minimum. So they're strong. They're engaged. They're building huge communities. And here they live sometimes in communities of millions without a government, without a religion, without a judge, without police, without foremen, without business executives, without any form of authority.
That is a very, very, very strong point you make. Wow. That's right.
It's a strong point on two fronts. One is God saying, if you want to be wise, then you need to be like the ant. I don't want you to have a leader or ruler. a commander, an officer, a government, any imposed authority, a dictator, a governor, a chief, a prince, or royalty, a superior individual or magistrate from the verbal root katash, one who cuts down, shears off, and scrapes away, determining borders and limits. I don't want you to have a work foreman or a public official or even a clerk or a scribe, an overseer, a manager, a civil servant, a military officer, a judge, a court clerk, or record keeper, nor anyone claiming to be in charge or control, especially a lord who reigns over you. Anyone acting as a lord or master, exercising authority, or claiming dominion over government, citizens, or slaves. That's comprehensive. So there are two things here. Is that absolute, unequivocal, unabashed instruction that we ought not show any allegiance to any political entity, any religious entity, any military entity. We ought not acquiesce to their authority or show any allegiance to them. And that these things are counterproductive from God's point of view. We want to be wise. We want to understand what he's trying to design. We won't submit to any of that. And the second is, this was written 3,000 years before any human understood any of this to be true. It is precisely accurate, but written 3,000 years before we knew it to be true. Would you trust the testimony of somebody who told you something 3,000 years in advance of the time anybody else would know it?
Yep, and I do.
I do too.
And we do.
And we do.
There's a signature for you.
That's a signature. I read that. That was a signature moment for me, man. I just read that and I said, "Wow!" And then what I did is I opened my Google search engine and I started reading everything I could read on ants. And I read a lot on ants because I thought it was important. I said, "Okay, ants operate under the highest level of what's called eusociality." Which is to say that their interactions are defined by the following characteristics. First, they are cooperative and supportive in their care for offspring, with overlapping generations engaged in sharing responsibility. And there is a division of labor whereby every ant works diligently at their speciality. And they either contribute to protect the colony, harvest food for the colony, enhance the nest of the colony, fertilize the eggs, or care for the young. They're all working, doing what they're
doing. How many was that? Now, wait a minute. How many was that? I didn't count that as you said it. How many?
Oh, I just went through it, okay. So their characteristics, they're cooperative and supportive in their care for their offspring, with overlapping generations engaged in sharing responsibility. And then the division of labor is they're all and their specialty. And their specialty is they either contribute to protect the colony, harvest the food for the colony, enhance the nest of the colony, fertilize the eggs of the colony, or the seventh one is they care for the young. Okay, so
there's seven. That's what I'm seven. Saying.
Yeah, there are seven.
How odd might that be?
Yes, it's seven. Okay, there are seven. Okay, so God's showing off. And
just a little.
Yeah. Okay, and while there are queen ants, it's an unfortunate human extrapolation because they are not married to kings. They have no organizational authority, and they often share colonies with many other queens. Their function is to lay eggs. Without any leadership, without a military officer, a political official, a business executive, or an individual engaged establishing laws, rules, or rules of conduct, morality, or justice, and these ants thrive without government or religion. Ants work together and engage cooperatively, especially for the benefit of their offspring. Also telling, the overwhelming preponderance of ants are females, which is why the ant is referred to as she throughout this presentation. The largest known colony of ants contained an estimated 306 million worker ants and 1 million queens, living in an interconnected mesh of 45,000 nests. This, like all ant colonies, was supportive even in the most hostile climes, because the workers collected more food and material than was currently needed and stored much of what they collected to see them through tough times and for the benefit of future generations. Of course, however, none of this was known 3,000 years ago when this proverb was penned. This is what God says next. She prepares her food in the summer. She gathers in the harvest for her storable food, serving as a future source of nourishment. You know, the communist thing would be from each according to their ability, to each according to their need, you know, and people will say of the person that's successful, they have more than they need.
Yeah,
God's saying that's a good thing. God's saying that's a good thing. I'm happy for you to have more than you need. In fact, the ant always has more than what they need.
Yeah,
the ant's not reliant on Social Security.
No.
The ant has prepared in advance. They've done the right thing for their family and for their offspring by collecting more than what was needed and doing the work in advance so they were ready. You know, we have that the whole story in Egypt, where we have the prophecy about the seven fat cows and the seven lean cows and what it represents, and that Egyptians needed to store far more grain than they ate for 7 years, so they'd have grain to eat for the 7 years of famine. Yeah, I was saying, yeah, that's what the ant does. You know, you ought to prepare for your own retirement, even, is what God is saying here. Now, you know, God's not cold. You know, he says, you know, bad things happen to people along the way. And if something bad has happened along the way, he wants those who are productive to enable those who have had, you know, life throw them some really nasty change-ups and curves to have the opportunity. But he doesn't say, give them money. He says, you know, provide a corner of your field so that they can come and harvest food to eat. But they're going to prepare it. They're going to harvest it. They're going to prepare it. Provide them some food
and sadly,
they can build a home. Provide them some
sadly,
fabric.
Sadly, the governments that are in opposition to the Torah have made it impossible for people to retire, for the most part. I mean, really,
that's
just
correct.
Flatly impossible.
Yeah, because they want you to be dependent. God is saying, I don't
want
you
to be
more
point.
Like
you
don't
now, every time we get
government.
Ahead, we're writing
right.
checks out, like right and left, and this is how it's going to go, and I know that.
Yeah.
So I just
so then
think,
this
you know,
is what he says. For how long and to what extent, inactive, apathetic, and lethargic one, will you just lie there and remain inactive? When and what will it take for you to arise and stand up? Wow. Now, that's the thing that I think makes being part of the Iowa family so much fun. You're standing up right in front of the crowd. The crowd's all going the opposite direction. You're looking them right in the face. You're standing strong. And you're just saying, you know, I'm going to stand up and I'm going to buck the crowd. And it feels good. But God is saying, but what about you that you're not active? You're just sitting there like a bump on a log. How long are you going to do that? Now, what's it going to take? When are you going to recognize that if you want to get ahead in life, you need to stand up. You need to open your eyes. You need to engage. You need to move. And by the way, I'm not talking about getting ahead in life in terms of making a buck, about climbing the social ladder.
You're talking about real life. Yeah,
I'm talking about real life.
Eternal.
If you want to get ahead in real life, which means that you engage in the covenant, you can't do that unless you open your eyes. You can't do that unless you walk away from religion. Unless you take a stand and you stand up and you start moving and you engage and you become observant, you aren't going to move ahead in real life. That's what he's saying here. You ought not be part of the entitlement generation because it'll ruin you.
Well, you don't even need
it. It's going to ruin you. It'll take your life away from you.
Yeah, well, they steal from the productive and give to those who are not productive. That's themselves primarily.
Right.
But
and it destroys everybody.
Yeah, it does. And having said that, what we're talking about here is reality, which he's talking about storing up those things that might make you live forever, which would be kind of important. At least that's what I'm getting out of this.
Yeah. He's saying, okay, a little inactivity. All right, so a little inactivity, a small amount of idleness, a little laziness, a limited amount. A limited amount of folding one's hands together in a lethargic manner to rest. You know, he says, I got no problem with that. A little of it's okay. You know, we're going to, every seventh day, we're going to take a break anyway. Yeah, a little rest. Okay, got no problem. So he's saying, listen, I got no problem with a little rest. But that's not humanity's problem. The people that aren't getting ahead in life, real life, are spending far more time apathetic and comatose in an altered state, unengaged, than they are engaged. I mean, how many people do you know that spend a significant amount of their time coming to know Yahweh, being observant when it comes to His testimony? How many people do you know that like this group, are willing to stand up and tell the truth according to what He had to tell us? Most people are sluggards. He says, so what's it going to take? What is it going to take? Because if you don't make that first move, we are never going to get anywhere. So what is it going to take? How long are you going to be lethargic? When are you going to make a stand? When are you going to stand up? Then it says, this is really interesting, and I can't tell you that I've got it translated correctly. I can just tell you this is the best I can do. And it says, for He will come, walking and behaving like a leader or guide, taking control. And you will come to lack what is needed and have a scarcity of something absolutely vital, needing what you don't have, causing you to be bereaved and diminished. Now, the reason I say I can't tell you that for sure I have this translator right is that I looked at every one of the lexicons and I said, oh boy, I can't get where they got, because most of them go to there's a thief, and the thief is from Halak. Well, the primary meaning of Halak is to walk, and then you look at the secondary meanings of Halak. You know, it's to take a leadership role in your walk, to guide by walking. You know, to take control by walking. And so I could extrapolate it. He will come, which is Bo. Which that's all it means. He will come, walking and behaving like. And you can't get these. It ain't there. But you can get. He's going to come walking, behaving like a leader or guide, taking control. You can get that from all of the lexicons. All of them give secondary and tertiary meanings to Halak, which are related to, you know, to taking a stand, to moving, to a certain conduct of life, to walking as leader, guide, taking control. And then resh means, it's usually translated poverty. But it's translated poverty because what it means is that this person is going to walk into your world. And when they do, because you've been apathetic, you're going to lack what's needed. And what's needed is an understanding of the Torah. What's needed is the benefits of the covenant, and you're not going to have them. And this person is going to walk into your life, walk into your world as a leader, and when that happens, because you were not prepared, because Yahweh is not, he told you to look at the ant, and the ant's collecting food for a rainy day. He's not telling you to go collect food for a rainy day. What is he telling you to do? He says, when the getting is good, why don't you spend that time accumulating knowledge about my Torah so that you have a war chest of understanding that you can deploy when the time is right.
Yeah, that's the real life we're talking about. Because
that's the real life. So he's saying that if this person walks into your world and takes control, claiming to be a leader and God, if you haven't taken a stand, if you haven't engaged, if you've been apathetic, then you're going to lack what's needed. you're going to be impoverished without what is required to survive.
Yeah, can I make a point here? It is all about lack of understandings. You know, over the past probably 40 years, you know, you've probably seen, and probably everybody out here has seen, at least, you know, 10 dozen cartoons where some poor homeless schmuck out, you know, I don't mean to cast aspersions at people getting rough situations, but they want to show Yahusha, of course they're portraying him as Jesus, as being an absolute bum, no job, no nothing, no anything, and he's out there. They have some guy with long hair.
He's the homeless one that you're not taking care of.
You're not taking care of him, and it's just, it's part of the whole problem.
Like when he says, you know, I was thirsty, and you didn't give me drink, and I was hungry, and you didn't give me food, and I was naked, you didn't clothe me, and so they depict him as the homeless individual. But Yahusha has a home.
Yeah.
He is the firstborn child into the home. He has absolutely got a home, and he's got beautiful apparel, and he's got the most nourishing things to eat, so he isn't any of those things. And so it's an errant presentation of it. But God is saying, if you haven't stored this up, when you had the opportunity, you know, when you were, your eyes were good enough to see, you had the time, you had the money to invest in the tools, when you had the opportunity and you didn't capitalize on it, then someone's going to walk into your life and he's going to surely come and you're just not going to have what's needed. And you're going to have a scarcity of something that's absolutely vital, needing what you don't have, causing you to be bereaved and diminished, causing you to be decreased and abated, ceasing to exist.
Is this the tallest one?
It could be. Could be Paul. You know, it could be any government or religious leader that influences somebody. And, you know, here they are. They were befuddled. They were apathetic. They didn't know what was necessary. And they were led astray by this person. And then they're just going to be found lacking.
Well, it's about discernment.
You need to engage.
It's about discernment. If you can't discern right from wrong, and most people can't. Most people are absolutely, they're unarmed. They cannot discern anything anymore. They can't tell right from wrong. Most people cannot, not even a little.
No. And it says, you know, if you're ill-prepared, then you're going to be found wanting. And by being found wanting, you're going to die and your soul's going to be dissipated into nothing, is what he's telling you. There's a reason you need to engage. There's a reason you need to act. There's a reason you shouldn't be apathetic, nor should you be in a reduced state of awareness, is because then it's really easy for someone to come into your world and to influence you in a leadership position such that you're vulnerable and are ultimately found lacking, dead and diminished to nothingness.
Yeah, they should have took some time to learn. They should have been gleaning the words. They should have been in deep consideration of what's going on. They should have been making connections, or they should have been doing translations and doing both, which is what
the four of us have gained a great deal. We've learned a great deal. We've gained a great deal, but we all have one thing in common. We've all invested the time. We've all found it enjoyable to engage. We have constantly pushed the thresholds of what we can learn from Yahweh. We're not found wanting because of the fact that we have chosen to take a stand, to open our eyes, to be engaged, to be active.
Does anyone feel that someone could come in and snap them away? I certainly don't.
Zero chance. But they can't even do that.
No, they can't ultimately, JB. They can't even do that. Yeah,
there's no way that we're lacking in anything. There is no chance under any circumstance that anybody could deceive any of us now about anything that's material. Yeah. Can't be done.
Well, there's a place I always wanted to be, and I feel like I am.
Yeah.
I will say, I got it. I got to tell you, on some Mikra days, I feel wanting a little bit, but it's just because I'm always alone, or mostly.
Oh, well, occasionally I feel wanting.
Those things you won't.
In fact, I don't want all the time. I want to know more. I want to do better translations. I want more insight, and I'm also want the thrill of us being together in eternity as light and being able to go explore the universe. We want a lot of things. The moment we stop wanting,
life without wanting would be boring.
Would be awful. So I'm glad you have some wants. What you're saying is you have some feelings occasionally of inadequacy when you're doing the Mikra.
I know I shouldn't, okay? Because my understanding, you're up there with probably some of the greatest in the world, I think. I'm pretty sure. I think you're going to get the greatest understandings in the world. And if anybody's listening to this that aren't covenant and part of the group here, they're going to think I'm sounding arrogant and haughty when really the opposite.
You can be arrogant in Yahweh.
Yeah, well,
I'm proud of what he's given to us.
I'm here to tell you that, shy of this group, I don't think there's anybody with understanding.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean that.
Yeah, I agree. Occasionally you'll hear somebody say something that shows that they have a 1% appreciation for what's going on, like Tony Blair taking a 1% responsibility role in the invasion of Iraq leading to the Islamic State and admitting culpability. But if you read everything else he said, he has a 1% understanding of what he did wrong. You know, 1% accountable, a 1% understanding, but that's pretty unique for a world leader to even have a 1% accountability and understanding. Yeah. And I think that for most part, most people and all leaders lack this. And it's something that we have in spades. And there is no one that's going to come into our life and mislead us. Not about anything that's important, because our foundation is the Torah. So he transitions from this to a really interesting presentation about what is always presented as a singular individual. So far he's been talking to the victims of religion and politics and how not to be a victim of religion and politics. So he's saying, I don't like societal institutions, and I don't like laziness, and this is how you avoid being entangled in these things. So he's speaking to his children, but now he's telling his children that there's one guy out there that you really need to be worried about. And that one guy happens to be Paul. Now, during different times, you could make a claim that there's other people that this would fit in, but it only really fits in a totality Paul, and secondarily to the Torahless one, because the Torahless one is there is no such thing as reincarnation. The same demon that possessed Paul is going to possess the Torahless one. He's going to be essentially the Paul was a prototype for the Torahless one. As a matter of fact, I think it would be appropriate to call Paul the Torahless one. I think he's the more of a Torahless one than even the so-called
manipulation.
When he wishes that people under the Torah be castrated, I'm gonna give you that. He's about as Torahless as you're gonna get.
I'm going to ask that Yahweh allow you to question him regarding the castration of those under the covenant when he has his trial. I have my favorites that I'm going to bring up. But I would like you, Larry, to be able to bring that up. We're gonna request that. I really want to rub it. I mean, I hate the man. I really want to rub it in his face. And I understand that Yahweh and his Malach can do a much better job of Paul than you and I. But I'd still like to take my swipes.
I'll bet you would.
Okay.
You probably have more material and more room to speak than any man on earth right now. So.
Yeah,
I'll
sit back
and let you do the work on that.
I really want to do it, and I realize that Yahoo can do a better job.
You're the best at it.
Yeah, it would be better. But still, I really want to do it. The guy I really want to do is Hadrian. I really dislike Hadrian.
Oh, he's
the two guys that I most want to do.
What a Nimrod.
Oh, God, I hate that guy.
What a Nimrod.
He's a Nimrod. Okay. A wicked and worthless person. A wicked and worthless person. This is Baal Yahal. And it's got Baal all written all over it.
That's as bad as it gets.
Vile and evil, troublesome and abhorred, detested and valueless, an ungodly and unprofitable, destructive and corrupt, from Bali, to be lacking and without, to be negated and for naught, to be worn out, completely used up. So a wicked and worthless person, an unjust, false, evil, and vain. It's transliterated as a then in your Funk and Wagnall, but it's alone. A wicked, egotistical, invalid, unreliable, corrupt, harmful, relationally damaging, untrue, fraudulent, and religious, troublesome, idolatrous, and person. And understand that a win is indistinguishable from a win in the text. And a win is the name of the most prominent of the Egyptian religious centers at the time.
Wow.
So a religious person who is fraudulent. A person who is vile and evil, detested and abhorred. This man, and he used two terms for man. The first term for man was Adam. Now, Paul would qualify as an Adam. The second is Ish, male individual.
Yeah.
Now, I think, I'm just guessing here. This is what struck me at the time. And don't claim to be right, but I just say what struck me. Satan is an Ish. He's a male individual.
Sure he is.
Paul is an Adam. He's a man.
Mm-hmm. So it's
Paul did not create those letters. He did not create Christianity on his own. By his own admission and by the obvious content of his letters, he was demon-possessed. And so this wicked individual is this religious and false, fraudulent individual. It's a demon-possessed man. That's why he used Adam and Eve.
Yeah, we had a conversation about that, and I said I really don't see demon possession in the Torah, but I'll admit I was wrong now. Yeah, sure. But I think that these demon-possessed men, if you will, are usually leaders.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, most often,
this is a demon-possessed man, but when he's saying here, that you've got an individual that is rotten to the core, and you've got a man that's rotten to the core, and you've got an individual being that is fraudulent and religious.
Yeah.
It just screams to me that he would not have used the different terms unless he was trying to bring together, saying that this evil that he's speaking of is a blend of a pathetic man and the adversary.
Well, you know, he does say that, though. Remember, he talks in
I think we lost. Well, I think we lost Larry there for a moment. I hope Larry calls back. But that's what I think he's saying. Paul admits that he's this, and then Yosha speaks of the demon possession of the Torah, one of the last days. So I know, Kirk, you see a lot, and I did too, of the Torahless one, the Antichrist in the last days, in this description. And I see even more Paul in this description, and I think the reason we see them both is they're one and the same.
Yeah.
Both demon-possessed men.
I'm amazed that so many translations see it almost as just as a generic bad guy. They don't really pinpoint it at all. I mean, I can't read all that we went through and not come up with Paul. But, you know, I'm more conscious, I'm more aware of it, more cognizant of it, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, and that's my view as well. So what we have here is that he says that a wicked and worthless man, an unjust, false, and religious individual, goes about with perverse and corrupt speech. So you can't look at this as two people, because it's all singular. It's this one individual and this one man collectively as an undivided whole. So demon possession goes about with this perverse and corrupt speech. And perverse and corrupt are so important to us here, because nothing that Paul said, nothing that Satan conveyed in the garden is unique.
Mm-hmm.
Everything he says is a corruption of what Yahweh said. It's a perversion of what Yahweh said. It's all he knows how to do is to counterfeit.
It's the only power it has is twisting.
Right. The only credibility. And the reason he counterfeits, the reason he convolutes, is that he doesn't want to be known as a uniquely powerful individual. He wants to be known as if he were God. He wants to be seen as God. And the only way he can do that is to counterfeit and twist and pervert the testimony of God. And he has to have a religious variation of God that just looks like him.
Yeah, playing off a bit of what Larry mentioned a bit while ago about how most demon possession you see in Scripture involves the powerful and the ruling class, you know, Yahweh is interested in individuals. Satan is interested in quantity. He wants numbers.
That's correct.
So he would possess the more powerful people so that he would have control and influence over more people. Whereas Yahweh deals with the most lowly of people. You know, a shepherd, a guy on the run from Egypt. Rarely does Yahweh interact with powerful people. Dode would be like the only exception I could think of.
He was a shepherd. He had no inheritance.
He came on the scene
because he took the time to get to know Yahweh, and he had the courage to deal with that disgusting, uncircumcised Philistine.
True.
And because he had the courage to do it, he became known. Otherwise, he was a nobody.
Yeah. When he came to know Yahweh, when he engaged with Yahweh, he was, you know, as lowly and little as they came. So yeah,
that is correct.
Not one king was chosen by Yahweh to be a messenger.
Right. But you notice that when Satan walks loose in the garden, first of all, he corrupted and perverted Yahweh's testimony. He didn't come up with his own mantra. And number two, he didn't do any miracles. He didn't do anything to wow anybody. He did it with his speech. That's how it's done. Everything Paul did was with his speech. He took the words of his mouth and he wrote them down. But even he didn't write many of them down. He spoke them and somebody else wrote them down. The Torahless one isn't going to be writing books. He's going to do it with his speech. Hitler didn't do it.
Paul was Hitler.
Any other way but speech. Yeah. Speech.
Wow.
Then he says, in this sinister speech, this is what you should look for. Now, this really only applies to our day where we have television, because otherwise the vast preponderance of people would never get close enough to these kinds of the singular evil individual to know to look for this. But a sinister winking, an insidious and revealing narrowing, and a malicious and telling blinking of his eyes, a subtle signaling by shuffling, by shifting his feet, all while casting aspersions with his fingers. Man, that describes today's politician, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. That sounds like the last debate I watched.
Oh, man, they're all doing it. All shuffling and shifting and all with these funny-looking expressions and all pointing their fingers. Casting aspersions while pointing their fingers. Wow. So this is
the most script of politics I've ever heard.
Yeah, it is. So next it says, with confusing and false perceptions, with which invert reality in his heart. He devises and inscribes antagonistic schemes without consideration for the consequence, which are evil and adversarial, continuously creating controversies and contentious strife. As one who claims to be sent out as a messenger to do away with something important. Only one person in human history that fits that depiction. Paul. Now, there are a lot of misleading people who have false perceptions which invert reality. Lots of people. But I don't think anybody inverted the truth more than Paul. I mean, literally taking what he then called the Old Testament, calling it pornography, and then saying that the Torah was impotent and enslaving, and that the covenant was of the flesh and therefore evil. I don't think there's anybody that inverted reality to the degree that Paul did.
Paul was the only time Satan was able to get his own words put in on the same level as Yahweh.
Yeah. Because while Muhammad presented Satan as God in his Quran, the attempt to confuse with false perceptions which invert reality isn't really a fair assessment of Islam in the Quran. It is way too stupid. Paul was clever in the way that he inverted reality.
Of the Torah. Paul attempts to corrupt and twist the Torah,
right.
Muhammad was being hidden.
Right. So hallucinations and perverted myths which lead to annihilation from Habakkuk to overturn or overthrow, inverting and upending, changing by reversing. Boy, didn't he reverse. Converting through confusion with catastrophic results. Central to his inner nature and his ambitions and his motivations. He devises and inscribes. So you've got to have somebody that wrote. You know, Muhammad didn't write. He devises and inscribes. That's the primary meaning of Tirash, to inscribe. He devises and inscribes antagonistic schemes without consideration of their consequence. He engraves and writes down wicked plans which conceal the truth, drawing lines in the sand whereby the ends justify the means, motivating many to remain silent for the sake of peace. Meanwhile, scheming to craft and implement clandestine plots which cause some to be deaf and others to be silent and unresponsive. This is a blend of political correctness, and it's a scheme which promotes universal tolerance and acceptance of evil while silencing objective criticism, dumbing down the amoral and apathetic population. But it is Pauline Christianity. And these things are evil and adversary, objectionable and wrong, depraved and perverse, essentially bad. In everything, continuously, with everyone, completely and totally, all of the time. God's not saying, you know, where there's some good and bad and on all things nice, and this is just rotten to the core. It's always bad. It's continuously bad. And it's bad because it's not only evil and adversarial, it creates controversies and contentious strife. Bitter, violent conflicts through human knowledge and philosophy while claiming kinship. Boy, that's Paul in a nutshell. That's exactly what Shimon Kepesh wrote about him in 2 Peter. And Paul is the only one who made these claims while claiming to be one who was sent out as a messenger, as an apostle. And the only one who sought to do away with something important. The Akiba didn't strive to do away with the Torah. Paul did. Only one.
You say even Muhammad didn't attempt that.
No, he says, oh no, this confirms the Torah.
He said it confirmed him that it was all right and, you know, he claimed that it was corrupted. What we had was corrupted, but he didn't try and do away with it or null it.
Correct.
Well, he couldn't read and write, and probably nobody around him could read and write outside of the Jewish rabbis that were living there.
Now, all he was selling is, if you go off and act like barbarians and join my gang, you'll get to rape all the pretty girls, you'll get to enslave all the children, you get to rob people of all their property, you won't have to work. If you get killed, I'll see to it that that you end up in my God's brothel.
Allah's brothel.
Yep, so that wasn't really a thinking man's proposition, was it?
No.
But with Paul, this is what he enticed in people. And there is no one in all of human history that fits this depiction of this particular man. And I'm telling you, Kirk, mm-hmm. in this depiction, we're not talking about the Antichrist.
No. Because he has such a short window of opportunity. And this is
right.
the most quoted man in history. It's got to be Paul.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, no question about it. Well, guys, you know, we're really way past the end of our broadcast window. We're still recording but not broadcasting. I think I'd prefer that we jump back into this next week because there's just so much of this to the real meat of it is just now beginning, and so I'd like to pick up where we are and do this next week. Maybe backtrack just a little bit. We have it for people that listen live and don't listen to the archives.
Quick question. It was Scott didn't answer the phone this morning. Is he still everything fine?
Oh yeah, Scott took a personal day. Didn't tell me what the reason was.
Okay.
And the deal with Scott is he has been offered a job. He has notified GCN. The general manager of GCN's first question was, does that mean that Craig's going to leave with you? And what can we do to keep him? And Scott has some proposals. I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do in that
what
regard. I want to stop. I want to go back to writing.
You should do what
That's
you
want
to do.
That's
you
what I want to
keep
do.
The Friday show?
We can keep the Friday show, but I'm not certain that's what we're going to end up with because I know there's merit in these shows, but I'm feeling a lot like I've said all of this for so long and so strongly, and that if you haven't got it by now, how are you going to get it? Now, I do know that occasionally somebody comes in, and once a week or so, we have somebody that comes in that's brought to the truth by all of this, and that's worth doing. But so is research and writing.
Yeah.
So
you might look into having Scott help you produce an audio version of Introduction to God, and just literally just a straight audio version for people to listen to.
Yeah,
those helped me a lot when I was first coming to know Yahweh.
Yeah, that's a real possibility. That would be an interesting thing to do. So anyway, I don't know really the answer, but I would suspect that the job that Scott has been offered will start January 1st. Mm-hmm. I am taking 2 weeks off, the first and second week of December, which means Kirk, you, Larry, James, and Scott can collectively do shows during summer, all of those days. But I'm going to take 2 weeks off then, and I know that the program with Scott will end in January. Now, I had Jacob today, and I got to speak with Jacob during all the breaks.
Mm-hmm.
And Jacob was just, you could tell, it was like, why hasn't anyone ever told me this before? Jacob's saying, listen, I'm not religious, I'm not political. I have to produce religious and political shows for people. Why didn't anybody ever tell me this before? That God was like this. The truth could be found like this. Says that it may have been the most interesting 2 hours I've ever spent in my life.
Wow.
So, is it worth? I don't want to say for certain. And I'm the last thing I
want to do. You don't
want
to burn out.
And I'm not going to go, and I'm not going to say I'm going to go pray about it. I am certainly open to some guidance about it. But I am reaching the point where I know that I've said all this, and I don't know how much more good saying more of it's going to do. But then I also know that when Nick called and Nick said something that normally would have sent me off the deep end, you know, they're using yada yada as a Bible, that normally would have tripped my trigger. The very fact that I could be patient with him and turn what I thought was going to be a really, really negative experience into something I think might have turned out to be positive. Says, you know, there's some advantage of growing up in the medium.
Yeah.
So, well, I don't know. We'll talk more about it and think about what we do and how we go about it. But and I do kind of like the idea of just recording yada yada and an intro to God and even questioning Paul and the current version of it. I would
have audio versions.
Yeah.
So a lot of times I really can't read, and so having that I can put on my phone and just pop in anytime I want, stick on my headphones.
Yep.
Like I said, when I first started coming, I was a delivery driver, so listening to the audio versions was something I did a lot, and that helped me tremendously, being able to listen to it over and over.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of merit to that. I also think that there's merit to doing things like this. Like to translate something, and while it's fresh, to talk about it. Yeah,
it's been a long time.
I really would like to
thank you, William.
Yeah, thank you, William. Well,
yeah, two levels. Hello, thank you, thank you.
Worth
the
material. Yeah, absolutely. All right, gentlemen. Thank you. Thank you, Larry. Today's got cut off. Yeah, but thank you all for contributing, and we'll do it again this time next week.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Okay. Bye. See you guys. Have a good one.
Bye.